Your weekly pulse on the Milwaukee Bucks, straight from a Bucks legend. This is Here District with Marcus Johnson, alongside his son and 1995 NCAA champion, Chris. Here's MJ.
All right, well, listen, I got to read this because my son says that I don't give some of our guests their proper due, and so we put together this intro, which is so appropriate. She's an Emmy winner, a best-selling author, and one of the most consequential voices in sports media. From her groundbreaking work at ESPN to her fearless commentary on the intersection of race, politics, and culture, she has never, ever, 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 ever shied away from the difficult conversations. That's what we love about her. 5 years since the Milwaukee Bucks' historic boycott, we're sitting down with Detroit's own, straight out of Motown, Jemele Hill. This is Here District. Welcome, Jemele.
Thank you.
Chris put that together.
You put that together correctly. I really appreciate it. That was a very warm introduction.
Well, and every word said with the utmost of sincerity, someone that I've always had a tremendous amount of respect for. And before we get started, I got to throw this out here, too. This is part of our intro, too. Chris and I are the only father and son in the history of the NCAA to win a national championship at the same school. UCLA, so that we've got to throw that out there too, just to remind. You know, if you don't remind people, Jemele, they won't. They are very, very, very lax about giving you your correct props. So, but listen, we welcome you, and I like to do backstory, right? And just kind of get a little bit into a person's background, how they grew up. You grew up in Detroit, Michigan. You're very open, in your autobiography, which I haven't read yet, but I'm going to read uphill. You talk about issues that your mother had with substance abuse. I've had my own personal journey and battles with that same issue. How did that experience shape the Jemele Hill that we're seeing right now, just in terms of where you are in your life, your personal life, your career?
Well, I think it's two things I learned from it. One was resilience, and the other was empathy. A lot of people, especially in the climate that we're in today, I don't really see us as a collective having a lot of empathy for people who come from situations that are not situations that they desire to be in, but situations they may wind up in. And as somebody who grew up with not just my mother having issues with substance abuse, but my father as well, you know, to have broke your parents go through those struggles at different times. And also, you know, growing up in inner city Detroit at a time where regularly Detroit has 600, 700 murders a year. You know, I grew up, you know, in the height of the crack era. Right. And so I think growing up that way, experiencing that level of insecurity in terms of safety, in terms of just how to move about the world, is really informed my opinion about the things that I believe today, and why I do, I think, carry a very vast amount of empathy, you know, for people. And so the resilience part, though, was something that I think is just key. Just as you go through life, you're going to face a lot of different battles. You don't know where they're coming from. Sometimes you don't know what will be the extent of them. But I can always draw on the experience of having lived through some of the things that I lived through, particularly growing up, to say, like, as tough as this may be right now, I can think of about 10 tougher moments that I experienced growing up. Yeah. So it allows me to have a little bit of perspective whenever I encounter personal or professional struggles.
What's been your toughest professional struggle? Let's just start with that. There's one thing that jumps out at you that you had to go through that was just uber challenging for you to navigate.
Yeah, I know people probably have an assumption of what they think my answer will be, but I will be extremely candid with you all and saying, I think I'm going through my toughest professional challenge right now. And this is a very volatile time in media. People like me who have a voice like mine are really struggling to figure out where we fit. And there's a lot of contraction going on in media. Even though you have a robust amount of things happening in sports media with the explosion of certain sports, but I think networks have become so risk averse, I should say, with certain types of people. Because there are other people that they don't really care about extending that level of risk because I think they feel like it fits the dynamic of the people that they want to appeal to. And so when you're sort of outside of that framework, it's a lot harder for you to figure out what your next steps are. So right now I kind of find myself trying to figure out, not necessarily next steps, but figuring out what the next 5 to 7 years of my career will look like. You know, we live in Los Angeles and I don't think this city has still recovered from the writers and the actor strike of a couple years ago. Like it hasn't. And the content game is a tough one right now. And so it feels like a big log jam. People are very risk averse about the types of things they want to do. Everybody sort of wants to do what's been done over and over again because they feel comfortable in doing that. And for somebody like me who got in this to be great and to be different and to, you know, make sure that you push the envelope, I don't know that it's a great time to be me in this time.
Are there specific hurdles that Black women journalists have to overcome that you can articulate for our audience?
Definitely. Well, you know, just let's just start it from a gender perspective before we even get to the race component of it. The type of journalist I am was a little bit different than maybe some of what people typically see of women journalists in the landscape. Even though I've done sideline reporting, broadcasting was something I did after I already had a successful print journalism career. Like I got into this to write about sports. I didn't get into this to be in TV. And even on the writer side of it, because you're a woman, you're in sports, there is an assumed stereotype about your lack of knowledge. First thing we always hear is you didn't play. Meanwhile, Bob and Joe next to me, they didn't play either, but they just assume that just by virtue of gender, they just know more just because they're men. I'm like, for what? He ain't tackled nothing. I'm like, why would he know more? Right. So there is that assumed sort of lack of respect that you're going to get just based off that. Then you add on the element of race to it. So you get all the components and the stereotype that usually comes along with just being Black in America of the perceived sort of, you know, lack of credentials, you know, people assuming that you got your job because you're Black, which I always found to be funny because when I was a columnist at the Orlando Sentinel, this is back in 2005, I was the only Black female sports columnist at a daily newspaper in North America. Notice I didn't just say America. That is one out of 405 newspapers. But they telling me I got my job because I'm Black. Because I'm like, if that's the case, why isn't there more of me? Like, if that is really what your thesis is, that they only elevate you because you're Black, it would be, I would assume, more of us than just me. And so you have to, unfortunately, contend with people always thinking you're less qualified. I used to say, and this was true, is that sometimes feedback that you get from sports fans when they're mad at you, especially, is, for me, it's either go write for Cosmo, you know, Cosmopolitan magazine, or go back to Africa. It's one of the two. So I'm getting hit with both of it on both sides. And so I think, you know, that part of it, yeah, I think that part of it can be especially tough. But I'm really honestly thankful that at least half of my career, social media didn't exist. And so, like, if I had to deal with the level of vitriol that's on social media now, but I was a younger, less seasoned journalist, it would have been a lot tougher to navigate that. But because the battle looked a little different, I think that's why I can withstand some of the social media vitriol that I receive now, because it's just like, this wasn't a part of most of my career. So it doesn't mean the same to me.
Now you feel that social media, I'm trying to figure out, Jim, like when it changed. Now I worked at Fox Sports with Chris Myers and Keith Olbermann. Then we brought Kevin Frazier, the great Kevin Frazier. We brought in Stephen A. Smith. And they always kind of used him. He was like Scott Jennings is for you on CNN. He was like the guy that they would bring in to give the contrary opinion and to get us going at each other. You know, it was a night when but they wouldn't tell me he was going to come on air until 2 minutes before we were to come on. Oh yeah, Stephen A is going to take a counter opinion on. I'm like, oh great, you know, now here we go with this. But when did it change? And Denzel Washington talked about the opinionaires and everybody's got an opinion but my point with that story is our executive producer, Mark Mayer, he told me, Jamal, he's like, look, if you want to go far in this business, you got to stir stuff up. You got to get some controversial stuff. You got to be an insider. Be an insider?
Hot takes.
And I'm like, hot. You know, I'm like, nah, man, I'm good, man. I just want to talk about basketball. I just want to talk about the game I played, the game I love. But when do you think it changed into this hot take, controversial, the hotter the take, the more controversial, the more popular and more successful you are in this business? When did it change? Who changed it, Jamal?
Definitely social media is a driving force, because America is a consumption economy, but now we've become an attention economy, which is different. And there is way too much upside in gaining attention, be it the right kind or the wrong kind. People now look at journalism as a avenue to which you can become famous. And that was not the case when I started off in journalism. Like when I, you know, my first professional year as a reporter was 1997. I was a reporter covering sports for the News and Observer in Raleigh, North Carolina. And, you know, at that time, you sort of signed up for journalism under the impression that you would never be rich, that you would never be famous, but you love to tell the story of competition, of athletes. You were in it for the sport and also the journalism as well. And I think as you saw more journalists being able to cross over writing books, having TV shows, having radio shows, there started to be a lot more skin in the game and a lot more currency in creating attention. And I think some of it was just organic. Like I think the majority of people, especially when I first started at ESPN, which would have been 2006, the majority of people were on air saying what they felt. They weren't trying to gain attention. They weren't trying to have a hot take. It's like, that's how they felt. They were passionate about sports and that was fine. And I would say probably somewhere between 2010 and 2015, that got a little different, where you now had younger journalists who were looking at the journalists on ESPN and thinking like, I want to be there one day. I want my opinions to hold weight and to matter. But what they couldn't see is that most of us that were on air at that time, we had had careers as actual journalists. Like for as much as people can say about Stephen A. Smith, I mean, he used to cover the NBA. He covered Allen Iverson. Like he was considered one of the best NBA reporters and insiders in America. That's how he got to ESPN. And unfortunately, like with young people, they see him on TV and they think, oh, he got to ESPN because, you know, he's very loud and he has these bold opinions. Like that's not what got him there. It was actually the reporting that got him there. It's the same with Adam Schefter. Adam Schefter was an NFL insider. He covered the Broncos. He was also somebody who had a print background. A lot of these people that you see now or that you saw during a period of time, they were actually former print journalists. So they were bringing credibility to the table because they had been in locker rooms, covered things, had relationships with coaches and athletes. They understood the dynamics in sports. And now I think you're seeing less of that. I mean, pretty much journalists are phased out of television. And I do think that at its best, it works well when you have former players, former coaches, and journalists all sort of collaborating and having conversations together from different perspectives. But now, in this way, I'm very grateful that so many athletes have platforms because, you know, they used to accuse the media of being the ones that stir up all the controversy and have all the hot takes, and we're the ones that are not informed. And as you see, a lot of these former athletes, they perhaps shouldn't have microphones, but you see them. And I was like, so we weren't the crazy ones, all right? It's like, clearly there were hotter takes to be had that we did not have. And so What I am most concerned about as relates to everything, but especially as it relates to sports, is the death of expertise. It being no longer respected, that people, the unfortunate part about social media is that it gave the wrong people too much confidence to be stupid.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
As a follow-up to that specific question, Jamel, athletes having their own platforms, production companies, you know, they kind of taken control of their narrative. How has your job as a traditional journalist, how has that changed? Is it more about providing context to the athlete story? Because the news used to come to you and you were the reporter that would report directly from the athlete. I'm just curious, how has your job fundamentally changed because of these new platforms and the athletes?
That's a really great question, because I think there are, I mean, I'd be lying if I said there wasn't some of my colleagues who are a little, who are not as welcoming to athletes in the media space because they feel like they're encroaching on their position. I've never felt that way, because even though there are athletes now who want to be in control of their own narratives, I totally understand that. And if we're being honest, really sports media is to blame for that. I mean, for most of my career, for example, like if you're, especially if you're talking about in the spaces of covering primarily Black athletes. So we're talking about basketball, football, the two most dominant sports in America. The majority of people framing the stories of Black athletes are white, right? So it was, when I left newspapers, 85% of sports editors were white, 85 to 90% of reporters were white. So you're already, there is a large cultural disconnect. And so if you're a Black athlete that is coming up through this vacuum of never seeing or rarely seeing people that look like you talk about you and frame your story, you at some point are probably going to say, why do I even need these people? I'm going to just do, I'm going to shape my own narratives. I'm going to control that. And so some of them jumping into having a production company and in the media is because the media was frankly pretty irresponsible in terms of a lot of times in terms of how we covered them. That being said, though, as much as I think it's been a huge bonus to have athletes in the space, because I think it helps make us sharper as reporters, there's still a need for us, because there are still things that happen, things that we see that athletes are afraid to talk about and they're afraid to say, because as much as they may not be playing that sport anymore, but they still consider themselves a part of the brotherhood of that sport. And so there's some stuff that they're not going to touch that I am happy to jump into with both feet. And I think calling out the power structures within the leagues that they come from has been a real struggle for them. And so that's why I think journalists will always be necessary. You need somebody who knows how to hold the powers that be accountable. You know, it's a very simple phrase that most of us learned in journalism school, or if you're a journalist, you've heard before, which is our job is to afflict the comfortable and comfort the afflicted. And that's a different role than an athlete speaking on a sport that he was a part of.
What did that passion hit you? I mean, what's, look, so Mumford High School, I know that's where you went to high school, and that came across my radar when I was doing research for a screenplay that I wrote on Reggie Harding from Eastern High School. You know Reggie Harding if you're from Detroit.
I think
you do. You do. Okay.
I know the first guy.
Yeah, but he was the first guy. He's a guy. First, he was a character that I played in White Men Can't Jump. He went into a bodega or a liquor store in Detroit, 7 feet tall with a mask on. They're like, Reggie, you know, get out of here, man. And he's like, this ain't me. So that was the story that you heard coming into the league when I first came in the 70s. And so I researched his history, and he's another guy, drug addict, heroin addict, right from high school to the NBA, didn't go to college. But he played against Mumford High School a lot in the articles that I was researching, and Gilda Radner, you know, Rosanna Dana, it's always something. She went there, Jerry Bruckheimer. So but when you're in high school, the thought of being a sports journalist, did it ever occur to you? Did it happen in Michigan State after high school? When did that light first come on for Jamel Hill that sports is where you wanted to kind of hang your hat?
So I'm a little bit of an anomaly. I was one of the outliers that knew very early what I wanted to do. So I from the time I could remember, I love reading. And I think the best journalists are people who read voraciously. So I love to read. I love writing. But then I was doing more creative writing. And I also love sports. And because of the time we were in, you know, then when you wanted to keep up with your sports teams, you had to do something called read a newspaper. And so I read the newspaper quite a bit. Like, yeah. I my mother used to clean houses of elderly people. And yeah. One of the people whose houses she cleaned, it was an older white gentleman. And he had subscriptions to both of the local newspapers, the Detroit News and the Detroit Free Press. Mm-hmm. So sometimes because, childcare, even then it was expensive or just not existent, I had to go and tag along with my mother when she cleaned his house. So I would sit at his kitchen table and just read the sports section cover to cover. That created a interest in journalism. So I get to high school and Mumford actually has a journalism class that you can take. And as part of the class, you have to write for the high school newspaper. So I joined my high school newspaper staff in 10th grade. And, I was just kind of hooked from there on. So I've known since I was in high school, this is what I wanted to do. And started writing in high school. I worked for the professional paper in Detroit, the Free Press. I worked there my junior and senior year, answering phones in the sports department, getting acclimated that way. I went to Michigan State because they were considered the best journalism school in the state and one of the best in the country. And while I was at Michigan State, I wrote for my college newspaper and also had internships in the summer. So I interned in Lima, Cleveland, Detroit, Philadelphia, and North Carolina. My dream job, it was never ESPN. My dream job was actually to work at Sports Illustrated because I had a subscription. Like, yeah. Anybody who's ever wanted to be a sports writer wanted to write for Sports Illustrated. And so right. That was the number one entity on my vision board. Matter of fact, I was in my garage not too long ago and I had so many of my old Sports Illustrateds in there. Like, I still have the one when LeBron was on the cover when he was 16 years old, the chosen one. And yep. I have some other ones that are, great or whatever. But that was, to me, the height of what sports journalism really was about. And I wanted to be part of it. I wanted to be part of telling stories, witnessing incredible feats by people who do incredible things, being athletes. And the drama of competition was something that always drew me in. And probably secondary to that, and hence why I've shifted in this part of my career to discussing and writing about the intersection between sports, race, gender, culture, and politics, is because sports is actually one of the few things that we do together. We're a very segregated society, socially, religiously, but sports is different. You have a bunch of Laker fans. They could be different ethnicities, different backgrounds, whatever. What they got in common, they all Laker fans. And so it is through sports that you're really able to impact and change the world in a much different way than you are with anything else. And that was also a part of why I wanted to be a part of this.
And it's almost impossible. I mean, today that this show is going to be released is the day that the Bucks boycotted a playoff game. Game 5, I believe it was, against the Orlando Magic, 2020, down in the bubble. And so we're about to do the game for local TV, Jamel, and it's, 8 minutes before tip-off, no Bucks. 5 minutes before tip-off, no Bucks. And so my producer's like, what's going on? I'm like, hey, they're not coming out. I mean, if it's 5 minutes before tip-off, you got everything happening in Kenosha with Jacob Blake and the shootings and shot 7 times. The political part of it, I mean, how delicate of a balance is that? Are you able to be as outspoken as you want to be? Do you have to tread a fine line? You still got there's still some propriety and as you're talking about things you can and can't say. How much leeway do you feel like you have to express the true Jamel Hill and what you really feel about things? Or do you have to have a filter even nowadays?
I don't have much of a filter left, I will say that.
Fact.
It's a little difficult. I can't say I have much. But I will say, and this is probably what's so disappointing about this time, is that I think about where we were in 2020 and the conversations people were willing to have then. A lot of tough conversations. There was a lot of realizations from people about what our society looked like. It felt like we were willing to finally really think about who we wanted to be as a nation. And to see much of the progress, I guess you want to call it, that was made then be completely going now in the totally opposite direction, it kind of is a disheartening thing to see the power that and the hold that racism still has on this country. And it's the one, it's the narcotic we can't get off of. I mean, it really is. And the unfortunate part is the combination with the divisive politics and already the divisiveness that was always there about racism and race. You know, it's probably going to lead to us, you know, unfortunately, I sounded pretty pessimistic, I guess, but I think it's going to lead to us probably going into a decline beyond maybe what many of us expect or want to see. Because I think there's just some things that have happened. I'm not sure that we'll recover from, at least not in my lifetime. And so, yeah, I mean, I think it gets harder. And especially as you see that there is a willingness to silence people and a willingness not to tell the truth about who we are. I mean, it's 2025 and the most dominant conversation as we're recording this that we've had in the last week is about slavery. Why are we still arguing about slavery in 2025? Yeah. It happened. We know it happened. We know it was bad. Like, to me, that shouldn't really be something that we're still debating or arguing about. It's like slavery was bad. That yeah. Like, that's the complete sentence. But we find ourselves still arguing with people about the whether or not it was bad, because there's just certain truths that the country doesn't want to live up to and doesn't want to own up to, I should say. And so when you see that and you study, you know, sort of the fall of regimes and the history of declines, it starts from a place of being unable to accept truth. And I think if you're a truth teller in this time, it's hard. It's going to be hard for you because, as I said, we see now that people are more risk averse than they've ever been. They're worried about backlash. They're worried about perhaps even government overreach. They're worried about all these things. And so that moment, you know, thinking about what the Bucks did, what the NBA did in 2020, where they took that pause, I don't know the next time we're going to see something like that because of the direction we're sort of headed in.
What does that decline look like in your mind? I mean, you say a decline. Is that a philosophical yeah. divide, or is it something even more nefarious than that?
Well, I think it's going to be, you know, the decline to me looks like a weaponizing of education, which I think we've seen already happen, that there being a gutting. I mean, again, these are things that are already in motion. So I'm not even speaking about something that's in the future.
The Smithsonian Institute and all the stuff going on with the museums and all that.
On truth, on things that really we should all agree on. And even if you want to take it to sports, for example, because I've had this conversation a lot in the last 6 months. You know, it's interesting to me now when you look at the recruiting rankings of, the top high school basketball players. And I'm looking at where they're coming from and the schools that they're coming from. And it's just like private, 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 private. And as a public school kid, while, you know, private schools have always been able to attract the best students, the best athletes. So that certainly isn't anything new. But what has happened, the decimation of the public school, is something that's going to have a dramatic impact on who has access to sports and access to sports that we assumed that access wasn't going to change, like basketball. It's a, you know, all you need is a ball and a hoop, right? Like, I think we took for granted what that access looks like. But with so many kids, specialized coaching and these AAU tournaments and all of this, it's like basketball is becoming an elitist sport. And I never thought I would see that. But it's becoming a sport that's going to be hard for the average inner city kid to afford. Because, like, they're not going to have the same resources as everybody else. Sports is no longer going to be a place where you can get good. Sports is going to be a place where you already have to be good. Mm-hmm. And that, to me, is very representative of a decline when you put something that should be accessible to all people. It becomes out of reach. And then that leads to creating wide barriers between who gets access to stuff and who doesn't.
Yeah, I mean, that used to be reserved for tennis coaches and golf coaches, and now you can't go to a 24-hour fitness sometimes because there's so many trainers working out and getting $100 an hour and all that, and like you say, it's kind of pricing themselves out of the market for inner city kids who don't have those kinds of resources. So it's an interesting times that we're living in. So.
Yeah. I mean, and I really think the way that it shows up in sports is maybe the way that it gets people to understand like how these issues are intertwined or like what could be the impact on them. And especially as it, you know, relates to sports, because that is something, you know, especially increasingly now, it's just so many parents who want to professionalize their children like so early.
Yeah.
And they're sort of forgetting, you know, like, my sports career was done in high school. I played fast pitch softball, was a shortstop, you know, pretty good in my day. And the thing is, you know, what I learned from sports is, you know, teamwork and leadership and these intangibles. You know, there's a reason why there's a lot of women in C-suite executive positions. A significant number of them play sports. That's where you get positive body image if you're a young woman and all these other things. And so people kind of forget that really is the part that was the component of sports that always made sports special and unique, is because you learn all these wonderful life lessons while playing sports. You know, I've taken up golf in the last couple of years, so I'm like horribly addicted to golf. And it's true what they say is that you can tell a lot about somebody's character by how they play golf. A lot.
I played this morning. Yes, indeed.
You understand?
I understand.
This dude be cheating, Jamel. If
I want a better lie, I'm not trying to make the tour, Jamel. If I want a better lie, I move my damn ball. You know, if I get stuck in some mud, I'm not trying to get on the tour. I'm trying to have a decent score.
But you're upfront about it, right?
I don't have the hole in my pants pocket and drop my ball here. You know, like some of my buddies do that. I won't mention their names, but man, it's all good. But let's talk about Jamel, the WNBA, and you've had some really interesting hot takes on that. I mean, Adam Silver, first of all, said he'd be disappointed in 5 years if we hadn't seen our first female coach in the NBA. Before we get to WNBA, let's talk about what Adam Silver said about a female coach in the NBA. Is that realistic, you think, in 5 years for that to happen as we segue into women's basketball?
You know, it's funny because I just had this conversation with Swain Cash, who's a friend of mine, and she was recently in the Pelicans front office. And I had her as a guest on my podcast, and I asked her, I said, what do you think we're likely to see first? The WNBA having its first $1 million player, as in they're getting $1 million a year in salary, or a female head coach in the NBA. She picked the $1 million in the WNBA. Yeah. And that was actually surprising to me. And I asked her why. And even though we've seen like so many different organizations now, they're hiring former women's players or just women in general to be executives, to be in the front office. You know, I know with the Pacers this year, I mean, the architect of their defense is a woman. I'm blanking on her name.
Yeah, Jenny Buchek. Jenny Buchek. Yeah. Yeah. Yep.
Correct. Yeah. And so I definitely think there are steps and there's strides that are being made to make that happen. But I think 5 years, probably not. 10, I'll take 10. But 5, I don't think so. Because I think we still need a lot more women in that NBA pipeline to bring them closer to maybe being a head coach. Like, granted, things happen quickly all the time in sports. You know, Becky Hammon has been an incredible coach in the WNBA, won multiple championships. I don't know if she decides, hey, I've accomplished this as much as I want to accomplish here in the WNBA. I'd love to give the NBA a shot. Who knows? But I think it's going to be really hard for the first person. To me, it's all about the second person. And, you know, obviously, like Dawn Staley's name has come up quite a few times in terms of somebody who could potentially be a head coach. But I just think there just needs to be probably more women in that assistant pipeline.
Yeah.
And it's going to take a longer time for us to see it. But I do think we're going to see it. I do. And despite how, as a society, we can be very resistant to change, I actually see this as something that will go well.
So, Jamel, you think this is more of a flawed pipeline issue, not enough people in the pool, the talent pool to choose from, versus outright bias or ownership that don't want to take that risk. Okay, talk to me.
Don't give society too much credit, okay? I think it is going to take a bold owner, for sure, regardless of how many women are in the pipeline, because, you know, one is the having the belief in the person, and they're also going to think about the level of media scrutiny that that person will get, that organization will get once you decide to do something, you know, like that. And so, and even beyond all that, I think that the bias part is real. Like, let's just talk about the WNBA for a second. And this is relatable. The WNBA right now, this league is 70% Black. They have one Black female head coach in the whole WNBA.
No.
One.
Yep.
In a 70% Black league, okay?
Wow.
But we look at who's making the decisions. You know, since you have so many NBA owners that own both a men's team and a women's team, so that same level, they're going to be the same ones making those decisions in the NBA. And so and you see that there's, I don't know if it's quite half, but obviously there's a pretty big percentage of men who are coaching in the NBA and are in the WNBA, excuse me. And it certainly bothered me, the fact that some of those men, or in general, they have been prioritized higher than former players in terms of the hiring process. You know, at the NCAA level, I don't even think half the women's basketball teams are coached by women. So, like, there is clearly a bias there that says to them that when it comes to coaching, they consider that to be more of a man's authority, whether they're coaching women or men. And so, like, that can be something that's very difficult for women to have to contend with in that professional space.
And we just saw it with Lisa Leslie, who's pretty outspoken about, you know, being passed over, not given a chance. I believe she was on, I can't remember whose podcast it was, but she was like, I don't even want, you know, to coach in the WNBA.
I think it was Angel.
Angels, right? Yeah. But so you see it there. But as a quick follow-up, staying on the WNBA, with the popularity of the league at its height right now, you know, the franchise valuations are skyrocketing. How do you think the players should approach this CBA negotiation? Should they be aggressive? Should they risk a lockout? What do you think, Jamel?
I think they should be super aggressive. I actually think, I know a lot of people are like, oh, but they can't afford to lock out. I would be personally stunned if there's a lockout, because I think both sides realize what's at stake. But I do think that the owners understand that from a purely a business standpoint, they have got to do more to protect and enhance the product. So what that means is, you, as you mentioned, the popularity, the WNBA is through the roof. You cannot have a salary structure where it still is more advantageous for these women to go play in other countries. You're not protecting the product. And not to mention, it's a pretty damning statement that a woman who's playing professional basketball can get paid more in Russia, which frankly, than they can in the United States. And Russia, who has a terrible track record of human rights violations and its treatment of you know, women and everything else, but she can make way more money there than she can here.
Right, right.
They've got to fix that, and I think they know that. But the people who are, you know, sort of banging on this drum of like, oh, these women, they need to be grateful and this and that. Listen, if you look at sports, the sports labor movement, just in particular, the players, I don't care what shape the league is in, have never stopped asking for more money, nor should they have stopped asking for more money.
Facts.
Those salaries don't go backwards. They only go forwards. They never have. All right. Yep. And even if you want to take the NBA by comparison, when you look at the financial shape that the NBA was in the late 70s, early 80s, before Magic and Bird really were able to, you know, get the NBA off tape delay games, they weren't in great financial shape. But the owners came together and subsidized player salaries of the top players because they understood that one day this product is going to be something. Mm. And so the investment is in the players as the league is also growing.
Yeah.
You know, people, because it's women, they feel like they got to wait their turn. And I don't understand, personally, from a fan standpoint, why so many of them openly side with billionaires. You have a lot more in common with athletes than you do with the billionaires.
Right.
If a billionaire is losing his money, so what?
That's what I say.
It ain't coming out of your pocket. Like, why do you care so much about the money they losing? Like, all of a sudden, when it got kind of, when it came out about the amount of money the WBA was losing, people was acting like that was coming out their checking account. Like, you still getting paid next Friday. Like, what are you talking about?
For real.
It's like, what? Yeah. So we've unfortunately seen that sentiment from fans before, but I think the women are doing the right thing because, look, ask the NFL players who will probably, I don't think that league will ever see guaranteed contracts for all players. Mm. I don't think that'll ever happen. You know why? Because they didn't stand their ground when it mattered. So if you stand your ground now, trust me, billionaires don't get more generous. They don't. So you're better off going for it, setting a precedent, making sure for generations that this league is in a place where the players can make more and more money, as opposed to soft shoeing it, giving them what they want, and then never being able to gain this amount of leverage again.
So now I was around in the early 80s, Junior Bridgman, Bob Lanier, they were the president and vice president of the Players Association. We had Steve Mix on the Bucks. He was the secretary. Quinn Buckner was it. We had, all the officers were on our team. And so we were kept abreast of everything that was going on. And that's when they came up with 53% of the basketball-related income goes to the play. You know, so that's when all that happened. Help me with this, Jamel. I'm coming up on 70 years old. I'm from a different era. The WNBA All-Star Game, and Chris and I have discussed this ad nauseum, but the live streaming, the commissioner dancing,
the stud buds.
Where do you fall in terms of, is it just you're just having a good time, it's a party, or did it hurt the image of the league at all just to have that go down the way it did?
I know people are like, why would you wear the pay us what you owe us shirts, you know, when you have that kind of attention on the WNBA All-Star Game? And to which my response always is, particularly when it comes to demonstrations and protests, there's never a perfect time to do anything. Mm. And if you sit around and wait for people to be comfortable with you doing stuff, nothing ever gets done. And we have to realize the spirit of this league, the women that are in this league, they have been fighting for dignity and respect their entire careers. These are women who had to grow up playing with boys because there wasn't enough facilities for girls. They had to grow up not getting the same support that they saw their male counterparts get. That is a story that they've had to endure their entire athletic careers. So, no, they ain't the one. They're not going to so when it comes to letting people understand what they're fighting against, they got no problems doing that. Because remember, you know, we were talking about the bubble and what happened, you know, with Jacob Blake. The women in the league, they don't have nearly as much to risk as the men do. Like, they're not making nearly the money that they are. And they ousted an NBA owner and Kelly Loeffler, the former owner of the Atlanta Dream, when she criticized the Black Lives Matter movement and criticized them. They organized against their own owner and changed the history of politics in Georgia. They got the first Black senator in Georgia elected, and Reverend Raphael Warnock. Yep. So if you think that these women, when it comes to fighting for what's right, that are fighting for their pay equity, that they care about how this looks and whether it bothers people, they don't.
Yeah. Mm.
And I think it's paid off for them more than anything. And that spirit, I think, at a time where the league is enjoying its biggest success, they would be foolish not to continue to put their foot on the necks of the league and the owners to do right by them. You know, I think about the league that Cheryl Swoopes, you know, she was one of the original members of the WNBA.
Yep.
And we talked to those women and they talk about how they had to share hotel rooms,
yeah,
how they had like all the different indignities they had to suffer to get to this point. That's why they're wearing pay us what you owe us shirts. That's why.
Right. Right. And where do you place Caitlin Clark's? Is it the perfect storm of events to have that dynamic infused into the league at this point? But in terms of the racial component, I mean, where do you fall on that whole controversy that is so alive on the internet? I don't know how much people outside of Twitter and the internet are into it, like I follow. But what's your take on that?
So I think Caitlin Clark, this is like a perfect, much like Magic and Bird were perfect for the NBA, right? They came along right when they were needed, all right?
Yeah.
And, you know, even then, I think the racial dynamic was part of the reason why people became wildly invested in their rivalry.
Celtics-Lakers.
Any
more diametrically opposed as that?
Yes.
Celtics-Lakers.
You had two different coasts. You had black versus white. You had all the contrast that you wanted to have. And I think with Caitlin, what has been unfortunate, and this is through no fault of her own, she's a tremendous player. She is a generational talent. But there are people who are obviously latching onto her and using her to showcase their disdain for black women. And the aggravating part for me in watching it unfold is like, we can't just enjoy the basketball. And two, making black women to be the villain in her story, I think is so irresponsible. And, you know, I know that because she is such a transcendent player already, there were new fans who were not familiar with the style of play in the WNBA, so they didn't understand that this is a physical league. They also have to understand, frankly, that a lot of fans kind of need to grow up in their mentality for how they think women should compete. Because I find it so interesting that a common complaint you've heard about the NBA from fans is, it's too soft. They can't play defense. They ain't physical enough. Ain't no
like the '90s. Nineties and the 80s when
they're right,
hand checking and
there's like, we don't want to see them on vacation together. They too friendly.
Yeah.
They work out too much.
Yeah. And, well, need more rivalries. And animus.
Then all of a sudden, you see these ladies, you know, touching each other up a bit, and then it's like, oh my God. It's like, wait a minute.
She should be arrested for assault.
Right.
Assault. She should be arrested for that.
It's like,
it's a hard foul. Come on.
It's a hard foul, people.
True.
And not only that, Caitlin Clark didn't ask y'all to throw a cape over her puddle. She did not ask you to do this.
Nope.
She is a competitive person.
Yep.
If you watch her, she give it as much as she get it.
Yeah.
Period. Mm-hmm. And she would be insulted by this idea that people think that she needs to have this bubble placed around her. Like, nah, she wanted those shots too. She talked trash too. Right. Okay, I've seen it. All right. Mm-hmm. And so the things that we admire about competition, we can't suddenly be hypocritical and say we don't want to see it because it's women. So I just sort of reject this idea that, you know, that there is, I think a lot of the stuff that we have seen, certain things will expire. And we will, I mean, I feel that returning now because, you know, Caitlin hasn't played a whole lot this season. And I just saw, before we started recording, I saw a stat about how the WNBA has already shattered the attendance record from last year. And they still got another month and a half to go in the season. And so that shows you that there is a lot of people that really love this product. They love that Caitlin Clark is a part of it. She may have brought them in, but they're staying for reasons that are beyond Caitlin Clark. And I think there's so much more positive that is happening than these negative flashes that we see about this league from time to time.
For me, the evolution of Angel Reese on the court and kind of turning into the icon that she is off the court has been truly one of the most fascinating developments of this whole rivalry. Like, I didn't see it coming, I'll be honest. Mm-hmm. They talked about her bad for being offensive rebounder and a layup misser. This year, she worked on the game. She's like a legitimate point forward. It's going to continue to evolve and blossom. Her vision is next level. But the thing that impressed me about Angel the most, Jamel, and I'll get your take on this, is she's like a real life dog. I mean, the way she plays, she's like one of the meanest. She's one of the meanest girls I ever seen play. I just want to get your take on Angel, her importance to this, also this meteoric rise of the WNBA and its popularity being at an all-time high.
Yeah, she's had a lot to do with it. And people try to discredit her because they, you know, one, it's always in opposition to Caitlin Clark. And I do think there are far too many people who just enjoy criticizing and disrespecting Black women. And, you know, Caitlin Clark has become their avatar to do that. But the growth of her game, I think you're exactly right. I don't think a lot of people knew or understood that, like, she used to play point guard. Mm-hmm. And you could see vision still there, her passing ability. Like, it's incredible for somebody who's playing that position.
Yep.
With that amount of athleticism. And I think for her, it was just about finding where she fit in the offense. And Chicago, you know, they had a lot of injuries this season, especially at the guard position. And because they did, they were able to showcase more of Angel running their offense. And I think that has been a blessing in disguise. When it comes to competitiveness, I think you know what type of time she on.
Hey, every day.
Yeah.
You know what type of time she is on.
And she moves as fluidly for someone that size. I mean, she's graceful. She's beautiful to watch, just her movement up and down the floor. I mean,
And then a lot of people, you know, they tried to discredit her by saying, like, oh, she's just rebounding her own misses. If you watch her and her knack for the ball, I'm not saying she these persons. People, I always, hear you make a somewhat of a comparison. I just want people to sort of just think about it in their mind of like, okay, what does it look like, right? Sort of the elevator pitch. She has a knack for where the ball's going to go once it hits the rim. And like, that's a hard thing to teach. And it's what made Dennis Rodman a great rebounder. It's like 100%. He knew already where the ball was going 100%. As soon as it hit as soon as it launched in the air, and certainly by the time it hit the rim, he knew exactly where the ball was going to be. And so she has that same ability because even if you still take out her offensive misses, she still lead the league in rebounding. So like, they can't keep her off the glass. Like it's a real superpower that she has.
Yeah.
And I think the offensive growth part of it, you know, will come because, and I would say the same thing for Caitlin Clark is that I think Caitlin Clark should be really looking at somebody like Sabrina Ionescu, not just saying that because they're both white, but I think about Sabrina when she first came to the WBA, known as a shooter, right? That was what she was known as. And the way she's rounded out her game, little floater here, mid-range, like she's hitting them in different spots. She's more than just a three-point shooter.
Absolutely.
And because she has those other elements, it makes her three-point shot that much more difficult to stop. And what I wish for Caitlin, beyond just getting physically stronger, although part of me does wonder if that's behind the injuries, is that was it too much muscle growth too fast? And those tissue injuries, that's what I was just thinking, you know, that's just my armchair, not qualified as a medical expert opinion. But like with her, her floor vision, her passing ability is special. And when she adds the other parts to her game, you know, in terms of taking it to the rim more, like getting a little bit more creative around a basket, she is going to be a nightmare. But she's got to add those other elements to make her a more versatile player. And she got to get stronger with the ball. Like averaging 6 turnovers a game as a guard is
unacceptable.
That's unacceptable. So she got to get stronger with the ball. And people are like, well, why are they picking her up 90 feet? Because she ain't strong with the ball. That's why they pick her up. That's what you do. I mean, we've known that since playing on the playground and playing. Like you see somebody having a hard time dribbling, you in their throat. That's the way it goes.
Fact. Right? Yeah. Check that handle.
Check the handle. Yes.
Well, you reminded me of something when you talked about not being a medical expert. I used to always say I'm not a doctor, but I got dunked on one a lot in the 80s. You know, I got dunked on one a lot. But with Angel Reese, the final point with the Reebok shoes, I believe.
Yes.
But I love the fact that she named one of her signature shoes the Me Bounds. People try to use that as a negative connotation against her. But hey, you know, I'm going to embrace this. Yeah, yep. I missed my shot. I get my shots. I get my rebounds. Put the Me Bound. I love that. Finally, Jamel, before we let you go, you got your own production company. Great, great doc on Simone Biles and the twisties and the whole deal she went through. Exceptional. You were working on one about Colin Kaepernick with Spike Lee. I don't know if you've got the NDA. deal going on, or but what happened? Can you give us any insights on man, that would have been short of just brilliant with Spike and Kyle and all that material going on.
I actually don't have an NDA like that Spike has. So
good. Yeah, that's what we wanted to hear.
But I will say this though. I have a tremendous amount of respect for both Colin and Spike. It's been all love. I learned a lot working on the project. Invaluable stuff that was well worth my time. But mostly out of respect for them is that I'll let them tell their own story and whatever they want to tell it. And what I will say is that I really hope that the documentary Fairy allows this documentary to be seen because it's special. It tells an incredible story. And next year is the 10-year anniversary from when he did his protest.
Already?
And it would be really awesome if people could see the backstory and everything else that was with it. And, you know, I guess the only other thing I'll add is don't believe all the narratives you read, people. Don't believe all the narratives
I'll leave it at that.
Well, my other son, Josiah, was involved in a project, Ava DuVernay, Colin Kaepernick in Black and White, Michael Starbury. And Josiah actually wrote like a couple episodes, or one episode when Romare Bearden, the great artist, was a great baseball player who they wanted to pass as white. He refused to and stopped playing baseball and went into painting, and the rest is history. But we'll look forward to that. Colin Kaepernick, not look forward to it, but you know, I'm disappointed that it didn't happen. But, you know, check out the Simone Biles doc on Netflix.
What about Spolitics? What about your podcast, Spolitics?
Spolitics is it? Yeah. Spolitics.
Yeah, every week on iHeart, every Thursday it drops. As a matter of fact, you brought up Spike Lee. He's the guest this week.
Okay.
Yeah, so a new episode drops tomorrow.
Okay.
I've been really pleased with how this has gone this season. We're about to wrap up season one. We got I think 3 or 4 more episodes to go. And so, you know, people, they kept insisting that sports and politics don't mix. Well, I got about 40 plus episodes that prove otherwise. So, you know,
absolutely.
Yeah. Now, did you see Highest to Lowest? Did you get a chance to see what was your take on that? Spike's latest movie with Denzel.
It's funny because like now that I do more production work, it's funny the things that like stand out to me now versus just before I started doing that. Visually beautiful, very beautifully shot.
Yes.
Good story. I think people will be very pleasantly surprised by A$AP Rocky. Because I know sometimes people get a little nervous when it's like a rapper in a movie.
Yeah.
But he does a really good job. It is a high stakes thriller. Jeffrey Wright, of course, always outstanding. And, you know, Denzel, he's Denzel. Like, you know, him and Spike, they still got that same chemistry.
Yep.
And Denzel is he's just on another stratosphere. I mean, when I had Spike on my podcast, he said it. He's like, he's the Michael Jordan of acting. And this is just another project that supports that belief.
Yeah.
So I think people will really enjoy it.
So quick story, when Chris was 14, we're playing at the Hollywood YMCA. Denzel's out there balling. You know, Denzel played at Fordham, played at Mount Vernon High School with Gus Williams and Earl Tatum and all these guys. So Chris is posting him up, elbowing Denzel. They square off. Denzel's like, "Young fella, I'll kick your little young ass." And so I got to jump in between them like, "Hey, man, Denzel." But to put the period on the story, every time they run into each other, I run into it. We have a great laugh about that. Now, every time he's about to kick my son Chris's behind at the Hollywood Y when he was 14 years old, he was like, "That one of my better moments, Marcus."
Chris, you tried to fight Denzel?
Yeah, I was tripping.
They squared up.
I was aggressive.
They squared up. So
I had the bows on him, Jamel. I had the bows on him.
That listen, is hilarious.
King Kong didn't land on me or Chris Rock or something. Whatever. Anyway, listen. We're going to let you go. We appreciate you. I'm so fortunate to have run into you at the grocery store of all places.
That's right.
I thought it was you, but then I saw the Michigan State stuff on. I knew it was you. And I'm glad I approached you, and I'm glad you were able to show up and give us a little bit of your time. And I'm just one of your biggest fans, and this has just really been an honor, and we thank you and continued success at everything you do.
Well, I appreciate both of you getting to talk to you. I was like, now I've been able to commune with the whole family. I had Josiah on an episode of Spolitics. Now I'm joining both of you. So it was just great to be in conversation with you. And I'll see you at our neighborhood grocery store.
sounds good. All right. All right, Jamel Hill, we thank you so much. Have a great afternoon. All right. Thanks again to Jamel Hill, Spolitics, staff writer for The Atlantic, co-founder of Lodge Freeway Media, doing great stuff out there and all kinds of different platforms. And we're just honored to have her come by here, District, and spend a little time with us.
Yes. And if you like the episode and want to listen to more episodes like the Jamel Hill episode, you can leave us a comment on the Bucks Official YouTube channel. You can also support Here District by subscribing to our podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast. Please, though, give us a sub. Give the Bucks Official YouTube channel a sub. Check us out under the podcast tab and dive deep into Bucks content.
Yeah, we're working really hard to bring you some great stuff. And one of the things we brought you a week ago or so, Kevin Garnett, The Ticket. Tick, as you call him. You kept saying Tick. I had Ticket. Had to get into that. And during that interview, we talked about his impact on Bobby Portis. And I had a chance to run into Bobby earlier today and mention that. And he was just, man, Chris, effusive in just what Garnett, The Ticket, Kevin Garnett, KG, meant to him during his suspension last year. 25 games, I believe it was. And he thought that that was a big reason why he was able to come out of that suspension, hit the ground running, 18 points, 10 rebounds, his first game back. And he gives a lot of credit to the encouragement
that
he'll get you pumped up.
He'll get you going, dog. I'm thinking about it right now, bro.
Drew Bundini, what a hype man. KG at all
going.
At all time hype man. So that's good stuff. Other news from Milwaukee with the Bucks. Bucks just signed, was made official recently, Amir Coffey, Chris, a former Clipper, 6'8", 210 pounds, 28 years old, out of Minnesota.
6'10 wingspan, yeah.
6'10 wingspan, continue the youth movement, and just your thoughts on that newest addition right now for the Bucks.
It's a prototypical 3-and-D skill guy, legitimate, like one of those low-volume guys, really solid on the catch and shoot, just will make you pay. But perfect fit around Giannis, you know what I'm saying? Yeah. At 6'7", 6'8", with the wingspan, can guard pretty much 2 through 4. Really good in switching situations, things like that. Cost effective, right? He's a veteran minimum signing, so his value would be a surplus for the Bucks.
Yeah.
Being that they're hard capped and need contributors on cheap deals. Granted, he doesn't have a ton of like high-level playoff experience. But I don't think in this type of scenario that's really going to matter much. I think he's going to come in and and add some depth to the wing where the Bucks need it the most.
Well, and so I don't know this for a fact, but Ty Lue is the coach of the Clippers. He's a Doc Rivers protege, so I'm sure Ty, was able to provide some insights into what kind of competitor and how he would fit and just what kind of a guy he is. Just seems to be a high character guy. But the thing I like about him more than anything else is that he played 72 games this year, 13 starts this year, 13 starts last year. So he's a guy that can give you some positive minutes coming off the bench, or you can put him in a starting lineup, as needed. But Chris, in 24 minutes a game, last year, he averaged almost 10 points a game.
That's
now,
sick.
Well, and so the fans out there might say, well, what's the big deal? 10 points a game, 24. But you think about averaging close to double figures in a minimal amount of minutes. I think over 36 games, he averaged about 14, 15 points a game. That's a solid offense. I give him above average as a defender. And when you can shoot 41% from the 3-point line and average 10 points a game in 24 minutes, to me, that the potential for where you can go with that is really, really exciting for the Milwaukee Bucks.
You just have more options with Prince, Coffee now in that mix, A.J. Green. I mean, you have a certified bucket getter on the NBA level at 6'8". I mean, this signing, for whatever reason, people weren't very excited about it, which I understand. But on the flip side, I'm looking at it. when I looked at it, I'm like, wait a second. This guy is like a majorly solid piece. He's just a piece, right? Yeah. Still, how old is the guy? Like, what?
28 years old.
He fits the mold of this John Horst offseason of signing all the young groups. So guess what? To me, this is a home run signing this late in free agency. I'm rolling with Amir Coffey heavily.
Just I had to refresh my memory in terms of what his game looked like. So I pulled up some video. He's got that tight lefty, you know, shooting pocket release that he goes into. He's aggressive, looking for a shot. And as much as we love Andre Jackson Jr. and the energy and effort and what he brings at the defensive end, and Andre's the first to tell you that's who he is. He's a defensive player first. This guy not only plays solid defense, but, man, he is aggressive, looking to shoot the ball. Catch and shoot numbers are really, really solid. And I just think, as you mentioned, when you look at someone who's going to complement Giannis, you got to put a lot of shooters around him. Now you've got yet another guy along with Ryan Rollins and Gary Trent Jr. and A.J. Green. We're talking about Taurean Prince, guys who are over 40% from the three-point line. You add another 40-plus percenter from the three-point line to go around Giannis, couldn't get any better than that.
So, and let's say he doesn't crack the initial 9- or 10-man rotation or whatever that's going on at the beginning of the season. He is excellent insurance, depth, quality wing insurance in the event anything happens. So, like, considering where the Bucks were, being hard cap, and what options they legitimately had, I feel like this was a home run signing.
Yeah, and if he ever like has an attention kind of waning moment on the sidelines during a timeout,
here we go.
he's got the great wake up artist in Giannis right there to wake him up,
slap him on the back of his neck.
Somebody shot me. Slap him on the back of the head, but no, it's all good, man.
How about Giannis though? How about Giannis?
Overseas? What he's doing overseas? What he's playing? Yeah. What did he put up recently?
25 and 10 in 20 minutes.
Minimal
like
minutes. Yeah, he looks good.
He looks really good.
He looks real. I've seen him pushing the ball coast to coast and just taking off.
I'm just saying, man. This EuroBasket thing ain't so bad, MJ. this EuroBasket thing ain't so bad, bro.
Knock
on wood like a mug.
Right. We'll keep crossing myself.
And knocking. Okay.
Yeah, now he's still coming to camp in a great, not only a great physical shape from this experience, but mentally. I mean, just that. And not that Giannis needs any more of a mental edge, but to come in, when hitting the ground running with that kind of a mental edge for Giannis could be scary for the opposition here early. So it's all good, all fun. All right, man. Listen, great show. Again, thank you to Jamel Hill for stopping by and just giving us all kinds of great insight and information. And Bucks sign Amir Coffey. We're excited about that. And, man, as the season just gets closer, what is this mid-August? So we got another 6 weeks or so before training camp opens up and things are shaping up beautifully on this fantastic voyage. So, all right, Chris, I'll see you next week.